Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NabTrade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Meg is an SMSF expert. She's represented the SMSF sector in the Cooper Review into Superannuation. She's incredibly experienced in super and the finance sector. She's dealt with financial planners, with accountants and direct investors for a couple of decades now. What is valuable for this conversation is Meg is not a financial planner and nor am I. So we've spent a lot of time dealing with financial planners and their clients and with direct investors. We're both somewhat removed from the emotion of this particular conversation. And we're hoping that we can help you, our listeners, and others with this issue. Meg, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Gemma. And I'm hoping we manage to keep some money out from under the mattress at the end of this conversation.
Yeah, or you know, don't throw it into something ridiculous. That's the alternative. So I'll give a bit of context on this one. ASIC recently released the results of yet another surveillance program. And this is really hard because every time there's a surveillance program, the numbers are pretty rotten. Specifically relating to advice to set up a self-managed super fund, so your area of expertise in particular, and it found that 90%, that is 90% of the advice provided was not compliant with the Corps Act requirements for financial advice. So sometimes that was poor paperwork and imperfect advice provision, but in 10% of cases, clients were likely to be significantly worse off as a result of the advice provided. We've also seen some horrendous cases in the Royal Commission. There have been a multitude of similar reviews and inquiries over the last decade. People are really anxious about seeking advice. Where do we go from here?
Look, I think you're right, Gemma, and all of those things you raised, the surveillance program, the Royal Commission, they're just more examples, if we actually need them, as to how important it is to get the right advice from expert ethical providers, but also how hard it is to find that. Those stories are pretty frightening for people and understandably would make a lot of people wary of everything in the finance industry. No wonder we have such a bad rap in this industry. But on the other hand, I think there are also a lot of people who've had some fantastic experiences with advisors. There are some good ones out there.
I will make a point before we go any further that you say we have a bad rap. You run a self-managed super fund administration firm, and self-managed super fund administration firms do not have a bad rap, right? It's a functional service that people are generally pretty happy with. So you guys don't have a bad rap. I work with a trading platform. They tend not to have such a bad rap, even though mostly because they allow people to invest and we don't give people any advice. You want to trade? Go nuts. But advice is fraught because it's a personal relationship and you are expecting to get personally tailored advice that will make you better off. Like, that's the whole purpose of this. So I'm going to start with a question. Do you personally use a financial planner?
Yeah, well, I do, actually. And I have done for some time. Both my husband and I are in the finance game. So you'd think we had a reasonable amount of knowledge, and we probably have better than average knowledge, but there's a lot we don't know about. And that's absolutely where we need an advisor. I wouldn't want to try and manage my retirement savings without him, to be honest.
Okay, so that's quite powerful. You've mentioned your retirement savings specifically as well. And also,
I'm too old to be saving for anything else.
You're not saving for a first time. The financial planner, in your case, I guess, is there to sort of fill any gaps in your expertise. I can't imagine they tell you how to do your SMSF administration and helping that you meet that retirement objective. If you're listening and you're not super clear about your objectives, and it doesn't have to be just retirement. That's not the only thing people need to achieve in life. But I would very strongly recommend you listen to the podcast I did with Paul Clitheroe. Paul has been around a long time. He does a brilliant job. He, in that, it's called How to Create Your Own Financial Plan. And in that, he does a great job of explaining how to get yourself set up. So if you do want to go get advice, you're not going to bore the planner with the first 10 minutes. You know exactly what it is you want to achieve in your personal situation. If you don't feel you need a planner at the end of that, and many people won't need a planner at the end of that, you've done most of the work to get your strategy in place. So that point about being clear on your goals and objectives is really important. I am going to speak about my own experience as a bit of a disclaimer as well. So my husband and I, we started a self-managed super fund on our own, and we engaged Meg's business, Heffron, to manage it for us. So do the accounts and the reporting and the compliance. We don't get any discounts for that. It's a purely professional relationship. So that's a trust decision. We've been really happy with it. But there was no one advising us to set up an SMSF. That was a personal decision. We were happy to make it. We didn't want a recommendation. But we did go, and we also managed the investments ourselves because we both worked in the investment field for a while and we enjoy that. We did choose a planner to recommend insurance for us. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that experience because we went to two different financial planners to get the outcome we needed. The reason we wanted a qualified person to look at insurance is it's a complex area. You think a life insurance policy is a life insurance policy, but an income protection policy or a trauma policy, they're not the same. So my personal approach to getting advice is finding someone who's got expertise in a field where, frankly, there's no chance I'm going to be able to get on top of that topic as well as I should do. Is that generally the approach that you use as well?
It is. So I think that there'd be some people who would go to a financial planner and basically download their entire financial affairs and ask the financial planner to be the project manager of their financial life going forward. There'd be others at the other end of the spectrum, and you're obviously there, who would have 90% of the base is covered. There's just 10% they know they're not covered with. And I'm probably in a similar spot. I maybe just have a few more gaps than you do. So we did the same thing with our advisors helped us a lot with our insurance, mm-hmm. made slightly more complex in our case perhaps by the fact that we've got a small business, mm-hmm. so having to sort of understand what the needs of the business were, mm-hmm. what our needs were, and make sure we got the right mix and held the policies in the right structures mm-hmm. for the insurance. But in our case too, we were not as confident as you are with managing investments. So I also have the same financial advisor advises us on what to do with our investments. But broadly speaking, it's the same approach as yours, really. Do the things that I feel comfortable doing mm. and then find a professional to help me with the things that I don't.
So I wasn't planning to go into this at this point, but it's worth mentioning. So I was telling a colleague this morning that we were going to have this conversation, and I'm excited about it in a funny kind of way. I think it's such an important conversation to have. Advice is valuable, and there are people out there who have the expertise to give you the advice that you want, but it is fraught as an industry. There are so many people who've had terrible experiences, as we've heard, and this particular colleague who does not have any financial qualifications, this is not a finance expert, said, I don't have an advisor, I will never use an advisor, they're all dodgy, I get all the advice I need from Google.
Crikey. does he rely on Google for medical advice as well?
I don't know.
Or maybe he trusts doctors. Yeah, fair enough. Look, I think that's an extreme view. So I think Google has democratized information. So we can all self-inform vastly more than we ever could before, and that's fantastic. Which means we're better equipped to maybe vet the advice we get. Mm. I don't think it takes away the need for advice though. So a good advisor wins over Google hands down, in my view. The challenge is finding a good advisor and making sure that particular advisor is right for you.
Yeah. I think also you're right about the democratizer. I mean, we're recording a podcast right now and it is available freely to anyone who wishes to listen to it, so long as they've got a phone or access to the internet. And there are so many people out there who are putting their expertise in the public domain and allowing people to access it. And I think it's a wonderful thing. The challenge for people is to understand the quality of the information that they're being provided. And that's difficult, right? If you're not an expert, how do you tell whether the person who's telling you something is an expert or not?
And have you ever
Googled? Back to the medical example. and then also, have you got all the information?
That's the thing. So have you ever Googled something where you are an expert and you want to know what Google has to say? So I do this all the time. And I rarely find things that are outright wrong on the internet. I do often, though, find things that don't ask enough questions. Mm. So they're right for the 90% of cases, but you don't know whether you're in the 10%. Mm. And as someone who's occasionally providing advice to other advisors, usually, I know that the value in the advice that I'm providing is actually the ability to ask the additional questions to make sure they are in the 90% and not the 10%. So I think I think I'd probably, I'd say yes, Google's fantastic for helping equip you to have a good conversation between equals with an advisor. You're far more informed than you ever were before when you talk to an advisor today. But I think much like Dr. Google doesn't replace your GP, Google doesn't replace your financial advisor either. Just puts the whole industry perhaps under a bit of pressure to lift its game and provide really good value for money.
I think, yeah, that's an awesome point. I've got a great example actually where someone used the internet to research something. Very thorough guy, very smart, very thorough, doesn't work in finance, works in technology. And he wanted to set up a self-managed super fund. He'd gone through all of what he understood to be the rules. He thought about it in great detail. He and his wife were absolutely 100% ready to push go, all online. Hadn't spoken to anyone, and then casually mentioned to me this was what they were planning to do. And I said, you are planning to move back to the UK in a couple of years though, aren't you?
Right, which was a problem that just hadn't come up online.
Just didn't come up. So if you are a non-resident, you should not have an SMSF, right? It needs to be a resident complying fund. So that was and it shocked him that he had missed something so important. It didn't shock me though, right? Because there's no reason for that to be widely publicised, because for most people it's not relevant.
That's exactly right, yeah. Yes.
So this is going to sound really strange, but I think we should start with some of the less positive stories. I've got one that really helped me understand what the average punter could face if they come to the advice industry and are not equipped to assess the individual they're talking to and then the quality of what they're provided. On your side, anything that you've experienced that was less than ideal?
Look, none personally, luckily. I'm a slow learner though. So by the time I realised it was important to get advice, I've been working in the industry long enough to have some good contacts and the confidence to choose someone. But I've definitely seen some bad cases professionally. And if you had to theme those, I'd probably say it's where people were encouraged to go into things they didn't understand. I know property and borrowing with SMSFs is a really hot topic these days, but probably because they're recent, they're the ones that stand out for me. So I remember a particular case where there was a client encouraged to buy property using an SMSF loan. There was nothing wrong with that idea conceptually, except that what we learned after the event was the financial return on that whole transaction only really stacked up for her if she was able to make some really big improvements to the property once the fund had bought it. What no one had told her, because she didn't understand to ask enough questions and the advisor either was giving poor advice or he didn't understand either, was that she couldn't actually borrow more money to improve the property. Yeah. So the whole, the financial metrics of the transaction then didn't stand up, but she was stuck. She'd already bought the property,
paid all the costs,
set up the loan. So I guess if you really wanted to have a sort of high level cause there, I'd say it was probably because the advisor didn't have a strong enough understanding of the structure he was recommending, and she didn't understand enough to ask the right questions.
That's a spectacular example, and ASIC has called out borrowing in super to buy property as one of their big hot button issues. They are very worried about that, and it is complex. There are, and you and I've talked about it on podcasts before. It's a complex area. There are things you can and can't do. And it was one of the Royal Commission examples as well. Another situation where people thought it was a great strategy, really excited about it, and flat out didn't understand the rules. And there is a bit of an assumption you can kind of bend the rules, which is not correct.
No.
Yeah. And in that scenario, irrespective of whether it was incompetence or inability to assess the scenario correctly on the advisor's part, it doesn't matter. She still lost money, right?
That's right.
It was in a really dire situation. So it's very hard where people say, well, advisors are unethical or they're incompetent. If the consequence is you lose money and you are worse off as a result of that advice, does it matter what the cause is? Mm. So I will tell you about our experience. So we knew we needed our insurance reviewed, and I think this might be telling for people hopefully, and help highlight some of the things you might need to look for. So we needed our insurance reviewed. We contacted a financial planner that we knew. We knew him personally. We both work in the industry, so we know a lot of people. We were explicitly just seeking insurance advice because we had had a second child. We were looking to buy a house, and we were going to have debt, all that kind of thing. Now, it took the planet, this is a bit funny, 4 months to provide us with the advice we had requested. So that's probably a red flag. What is important to you was clearly not important to him. He wasn't in a hurry to provide us with the advice. We did ask him personally and then give him all the information he needed via emails, so maybe thought we weren't in a hurry, but had something happened to one or other of us during that period, we would not have been insured, and that's a big problem. So that was probably a red flag from the beginning. We weren't well disposed to be thrilled about what we got after that. When he did actually provide the advice, so he gave us a really lengthy document everyone will get in a binder called a statement of advice, and in that the advisor will outline their recommendations, binding under the law effectively. This is their advice. He had recommended that we roll all of our superannuation into a product managed by him that was provided by his licensee, so the large institution that provided the financial advice license. Now, we told him we didn't want investment advice. We told him we only wanted insurance. And then on the insurance side, we had said, we are going to put all our money into the mortgage. That's goal number one. And yet he had recommended insurance that was so expensive it would require a $12,000 a year salary sacrifice on my husband's behalf in order to pay for it.
Crikey, he must be really old.
He's not really old. So that is incredibly expensive insurance. Right. Like, if it's costing you $12,000 a year, admittedly before tax, that was... far beyond our capacity to pay for it, and also not the kind of insurance we needed, right? If it's that expensive, it's more than you need. So we obviously taken one look at this and realised it wasn't great advice, but I did worry that if this was given to somebody else, they might feel obligated to take it because it came from a professional advisor. Maybe that person knows so much.
Yeah, wow. That puts people in a really tricky position, doesn't it? And it sounds like... In your case, I wonder, you know, you got the big binder, the statement of advice.
It looks very official and professional.
The advisor ticked all the compliance boxes, but the outcome was still poor. I guess that's the real challenge of the any regulatory system, isn't it? You can legislate for education, disclosure and all those good things, but at the end of the day, no one can guarantee you get good outcomes or that the person who's giving it to you is actually giving you the best advice. I suppose at least in your case you did get a recommendation to get some insurance.
No, we'd already told them we wanted it, so that we didn't even need that, right?
Yeah.
We'd ask for it.
It's a shame really, isn't it? Because, you know, insurance is actually one area where I've also seen advisors do some amazing things. Really save the day. I've seen advisors have very tough conversations with clients about actually getting insurance where the client hasn't wanted to engage with it and it's been absolutely the right thing to do. And I've seen advisors time and time again help their clients through the claims process, which can be really challenging. I'll never forget having a conference call over Christmas or something like that, where an advisor and a client were both on the call. The client had a terminal diagnosis, and the advisor was trying to help them work through the ramifications of claiming on the insurance before or after death. Now, you imagine how confronting... Yeah. That would be. Mm. And what I was impressed by, I think, was not only that the advisor was taking that difficult emotional challenge on with the wife there, but was also adding a heap of value, understanding how the tax rules worked. Yeah, and, you know, it was hard enough for me, and I was only on the phone and only talking about the superannuation aspects. But the advisor was taking on a big emotional load and a highly competent advice load on a complex area, which ended up saving the family a heap of tax.
That's an example. You know, so my experience was not great. And we were fortunate enough to be able to spot it really clearly. Like, it was pretty obvious that was not going to work for us. And yet, you know, someone else can give a completely different outcome from the same request, and that's the challenge. So let's talk about what people do want to avoid. Like, so there are some really obvious red flags, if we can call them out. One thing ASIC has called out, and we've sort of talked about it a tiny bit, is this property one-stop shop with self-managed super funds. So this is something that has been flagged, but maybe the community is not aware of as much as they should be. Can you tell us what they are for a start and how they work?
Yeah, so I think when ASIC uses that term property one-stop shop, which comes up a couple of times in that review they've done recently, I think what they're talking about is where one firm, or it appears to the consumer like one firm, deals with pretty much everything around recommending and then implementing a strategy of setting up an SMSF, borrowing to buy property in it, and then sourcing the property. Now, I guess, you know, we're both time poor, so actually, in theory, that doesn't sound all that bad, bringing a whole lot of people with the right skills together to streamline a complicated transaction. And in fact, a lot of the people that were interviewed by ASIC said exactly that. They liked the fact that everybody was working together, everybody was talking to each other, the complex transaction was made a lot less complex because it was a one-stop shop. And the investor didn't have to worry about project managing everything. But the problem, I guess, that ASIC sees and probably exists is that it's all a little bit too cozy. Is anyone in that arrangement ever going to tell the investor that, you know what, setting up an SMSF is not the right thing for you, or buying a property at this point in your life probably isn't the right thing for you? Have you considered something beyond property? Because probably the whole model is around getting that property delivered into the SMSF. Yeah. And I would imagine that that's where ASIC sees the main problem.
I think they've been quite clear, and certainly other commentators have been quite clear, that it is the issue where they're massively overvaluing the property. So the individual is overpaying for an apartment in Western Sydney or in Brisbane, where property prices have fallen 20% in 12 months. And they're saying, you should definitely buy this apartment for $700,000 when it's really only worth $550,000. And the difference is pocketed by the people recommending the transaction, split very neatly between the accountant, the financial planner, the property provider, and the loan writer.
Yeah, so it probably pays to follow where the money goes, doesn't
Who's
it?
Who's getting paid? I don't know.
Who's getting paid for what? Because the stronger the link between what you pay and what you want, as in which services do you actually want and which ones are you actually paying for, surely the more likely it is that the advice is right for you.
I think, so I was going to ask you, how can you spot one of these? I'll tell you how I spotted one. I got a letter in the post, it wasn't even a letter, a piece of paper, which said, did you know you can use your super to buy property? You know, property doubles in value over, you know, every 7 years. If you use your super to do this, we can set it up for you, blah, blah, blah. And I was going, this is, it was so explicit, the sale. You know, so there was no advice around anything. It was effectively, come to us and we're going to do this for you and you're going to double your money in 5 years' time. It was absolutely incredible. Like, no financial planner would or should ever tell you you will double your money in any time period, let alone 5 years. And yet this was a blatant sale, and it was kind of like, call Susie on this number and we'll set it up. And I was like, oh God.
And why are they so successful? I mean, I suppose it's because this structure allows you to unlock your super, whereas a letter in the mail that didn't involve tapping into your super to do that would just be an invitation to borrow and buy property, which you might be a bit antsy about. But if it's an
invitation, your cash flow.
If it's an invitation to tap into your super, the downsides appear less to you. I wonder if that's why they're so popular.
Either way, but I think also something to watch out for is anyone who promises you a return. Is the one thing an average, any financial planner will tell you, is they can't control markets. They can't control the investment return. So if someone is promising you a return, they might be able to promise they can save you some tax because that's legislative and it's relatively fixed. They might be able to tell you that they can structure your insurance correctly and those sorts of things. They shouldn't be telling you you're going to get a return of X or Y over a period. That might be something you can look out for. If you see that, maybe get worried.
So we won't have that little conversation about Bitcoin later on then?
Yeah, no, let's not talk about Bitcoin. So one thing many people are worried about when they... So let's say I've come to the conclusion that I can get some value from advice. If I have a very complex scenario, so if I have over $1.6 million in superannuation, for example, if I'm rolling out of a defined benefit fund, you know, some people just, their situations are complex. You do need to think long and hard about it. It's very hard to get sufficient information just from Google. I want to see a planner. Many people are worried about what's called vertical integration. So this is where advisors are either employed by a big financial institution, and that big financial institution either makes investment product, or insurance, so they make managed funds, they make superannuation, that sort of thing, or they make insurance. So they're either employed by them, so they're a so-and-so financial planner, or they might be licensed by them, which means they own their own business, but they can provide advice effectively on behalf of this licensee. It's tricky. So that licensee, that big institution, will set the rules that that advisor needs to follow, and they tend to be a bit stricter if you're employed than if you're self-employed, like if you have your own business. Advisors who are aligned to a big institution are absolutely more likely to recommend products from that institution, but it's not a given. So the advisor we now use for our insurance, not the one I mentioned previously, has his own business. It is aligned to a large institution. The insurance product he recommended us was from a different institution. It wasn't the owner product that people worry about. What are your thoughts on this topic, on vertical integration, on being employed or aligned to a big institution?
Yeah, look, everybody's pretty down on the vertically integrated model at the moment, aren't they? And I can see why, in that if I was going to use an advisor who was part of a vertically integrated group, I probably would want to understand things like, how restricted are they in deciding what to recommend for me? They're likely to be working with an approved product list, so basically products that have been pre-vetted by the licensee. I'd want to know how products get added to that list. How does the advisor get paid? Are they incentivized to sell the in-house products more than the other products on the approved product list?
I don't think that's permissible under the law anymore, is it?
Is it not? Okay, so. Well, that's really interesting.
Maybe
isn't
I'm
it?
Wrong. Yeah.
You may be right, though, but isn't that interesting? Because the research ASIC just did found that, in fact, it was really common for vertically integrated groups to have more of the in-house products sold, even though the approved product list didn't have a higher incidence of in-house products. So the approved product list, to the outside world, looked very fair and balanced. The actual sales looked far more like the in-house product was being favoured. So absolutely, that's a risk. But to be honest, at the end of the day, I don't think the legal entity that licensed a planner is a sort of number one factor for me, unless there's a lot of direction then around how the advisor behaves, around how they charge, or what really tight controls on what they can and can't recommend. I've seen plenty of advisors who would fit that vertically integrated model, who are absolutely competent, ethically strong, and who I wouldn't hesitate to use in a heartbeat. I think the only thing is probably fair to say about that model is it presents an additional risk you as a consumer should know and understand and look for.
Yeah, be comfortable with. So one thing on that, we'll talk about it a bit later, but if you do want to understand who someone is licensed by, every financial planner has to have an FSG, a financial services guide. It should be published on their website. It'll be in a PDF form because they have to give you a paper-based copy when you go to see them. And in it, it will say, I have my license through this business. Now, it is worth noting that the name of that business may not be the name of the larger institution that sits over the whole thing. So a lot of large institutions own multiple licenses and they're called different things because they've acquired lots of businesses over time. So you kind of have to follow the trail through Google and whatever. They're not trying to be unethical, that's just the actual name of it. But you can absolutely very quickly find out who someone is licensed by. So they may be called Joe Bloggs Financial Planning, but be licensed by a brand name that you know and walk past every day. You can find that out relatively quickly just by going to their website or asking them.
And look, that's not something they'll hide. And to be honest, the quality of the advice is far more dependent on Joe Bloggs than his or her licensee.
Yes, that's 100% correct. One thing that no one really talks about but is worth noting is that advisors need to choose who they're licensed by, right? So if they're an employee, they get a job. But if they have a business, they need to go and find a license. You can get your own license or you can go and be licensed by somebody else. A lot of them will choose to be licensed by somebody because their values are aligned to that larger institution, or they like the products that that institution creates and manufactures, and therefore they're more likely to use them. So it's not necessarily the institution is pushing the advisor. Sometimes the advisor chooses the licensee because it is aligned to what they want to achieve.
Yeah, good point.
So the alternative to that vertically integrated model, which has its challenges, one advantage is large institutions are more financially sound than small institutions, generally speaking, so is the independent advisor. Now, independence is very clearly defined under the law, so you shouldn't see people using this term casually. You should be very confident if someone says they're independent that they are. Under the law, it says they can't be aligned to any large institution and they can't receive any payment from any product manufacturer. So they can't take any form of commission, all those sorts of things. What are your thoughts on the independent part of the industry?
Yeah, well, look, I think independence as a concept is a good thing. I also think it's a bit of a myth in financial services or anywhere, to be honest. You can always be independent of certain things, but I don't think anyone can be independent of everything. So now I'm going to risk offending people and being a bit provocative here, Gemma, but ASIC isn't independent of the need for future funding from the government.
Yeah.
That funding is far more likely to happen if the community and parliament think there are problems to solve and ASIC's doing a great job at solving them. Does that matter? Well, maybe not. But maybe it does. Maybe it will prompt ASIC to find problems that it otherwise might overlook if it was genuinely behaving in an independent fashion.
I have never heard that perspective before. That
now,
is very provocative.
I can't honestly say, to be fair, I'm not actually calling ASIC dodgy or anything like that. But I do want to highlight the point that we talk about independence as if it's a gold standard to which only the very few
the best and brightest can aspire.
And I think actually independence it's directional rather than destinational. You can be independent of many things. You can ensure your business is independent of all the things that are important to your clients. Nobody's independent of everything, even our regulator. So
just a point though, your business is independent, right?
But we're not though, are we?
Oh, really? I would have, okay.
Well, so we're
You're not owned by a large institution.
No, we're not owned by a large institution. We have no financial interest in the products that our clients use. We don't get paid on a funds under management basis. So yes, we look totally independent. Mm. But let me think of something. If you were to come to me for advice on whether you should set up an SMSF, I can hardly be independent there.
Fair enough, yeah.
Or do I think industry funds or SMSFs are generally the better structure? Well, absolutely, I think SMSFs are the better structure. So no one is totally independent, I guess, is what I'm saying. I think, and ASIC have a funny definition of independence, really, isn't it? In the context of the corporations law, it's all about not accepting money from product manufacturers. So there's nothing, let's again be controversial. What if you had an independent advisor, legally allowed to use that term? They always referred all their accounting work to the same accountant, all their clients' accounting work to the same accountant, and the accountant always referred financial planning work to that financial planner. Mm. Are those two organisations independent of each other? I would say they're not. Mm. Totally valid way of supporting their clients, but it's funny, isn't it, that ASIC would allow us to call them independent because the planner doesn't take commissions. Mm. But that arrangement, which might be of far more importance to their actual clients, is not. So I would say independence, nice concept. Mm. I think at the end of the day, what's really important is that we choose advisors based on competence and suitability for our needs and independence relative to the things we actually care about.
I think that last point is excellent. So you may have a strong preference not to be aligned to a large organisation, in which case you would choose someone who's independent. But if you don't want a self-managed super fund and that advisor only recommends self-managed super funds, that's not the kind of independent advisor for you.
You bet.
Yeah, right. Okay. But really good point. So I guess what you want to understand as a consumer, and it's so fraught and so challenging, but yeah, the one thing we were talking about, Google and how important it is and how much it democratizes information, what it does do is, because most advisors now have a website and most advisors now have a reasonably good quality website, you can do a fair bit of research on people before you get started. So absolutely look at that financial services guide we were talking about. One of the other things you would probably want to look at is what sort of expertise they describe on their site. So if they don't mention SMSFs anywhere and you want an SMSF, you probably go, well, maybe they don't specialise in this. Or if they don't mention insurance anywhere and you're going for insurance advice, you might think, well, maybe this is not the right financial planner for me. Is that a good way to start thinking about
it. I think again, that's using Google and websites and freely available information in exactly the right way. Gather information, not necessarily decisive. What I wouldn't probably do is pick an advisor based on how highly they rated in some, you know, ratings system. But I would definitely do exactly the kind of research you're talking about. I think at the other end of the spectrum, I'd possibly also be worried a little bit about an advisor who professes to do absolutely everything with no mention on their site of the professional networks they use to cover the areas that are not their strength. So advisors are, on the whole, fantastic generalists, know far more about far more things than I do. Very few know as much about self-managed super funds as I do. So what you'd want is an advisor who says, well, SMSFs are or are not my thing. When I have a gap, this is where I go. And I think their support network is a very important part of how you choose someone.
Yeah, you do want to know that your advisor is going to, if they're faced with something that's outside their area of expertise, go and get the correct answer, as opposed to just guess or push the answer they give everybody.
That's right. I'd think of them a little bit like, in some cases, like a GP doctor. You know, I absolutely depend on my GP to ask the right questions and send me off to a specialist if I need to go to one. She doesn't refer me to a specialist every time I go, so presumably she's got a very high level of knowledge about most things to do with my health. But I do expect it to know where to send me when I need a specialist.
So final question for you then. I mean, I don't know if we've necessarily answered this question for everyone listening, because it's a very, very complex area. Personal referrals. We all, as humans, have a very strong preference for knowing that other people have experienced something we're anxious about, and they came out the other side. You know, like, yes. You know, we all love personal referrals. What are your thoughts about those?
Right. I think personal referrals are extremely valuable when it comes to things like cultural alignment. An advisor is someone you're going to have a relationship with for a long time. You've got to get on with them. If your friends get on with them, chances are you will too. But if your friends' needs are very different to yours, they're not necessarily going to be the right advisor for you despite all that cultural alignment. So if you and I tried to use the same advisor, for instance, you want insurance advice largely. I probably most of the time want investment advice. So we may be perfectly aligned values-wise and culturally, but would choose a different advisor because we have different needs.
Expertise we're seeking.
That's right. So I think personal referrals are valuable as long as you understand what information you're gleaning from that personal referral, which is basically, this guy's good at the stuff I need and I like him.
Yeah. So on that one, because personal referrals, I like them too, right? Everybody does. But I will say very clearly, Storm Financial, some people may remember, some people may not, but it was the sort of flagship disaster of the global financial crisis.
That's right, and it was built around personal referrals.
It was a financial planning business that was independent, so they were not owned by any large institution. They probably did take commissions back then, but different era, right, where commissions were sort of embedded in everything. They had one strategy for everybody, but you won't know that as an individual when you go there, right, because can't have a look at the rest of their client files. You can't ask their other clients what they get. And so they geared everybody into the market. So they had all their clients borrow and go into the market, and then they geared them again into the market. GFC came along, wiped people out. People lost their houses. People in retirement lost their houses and ended up on the pension. It was absolutely disastrous and very heartbreaking for many people. And they had built their business, as you say, on personal referrals. People loved the money they were making when times were good. They loved it, and they felt that these financial planners were the best planners in the world because they were making 25% per annum and 50% in a good year. And then they lost everything in a bad year, and it was heartbreaking, but whole communities went down, you know, groups of friends went down. It's probably...
That's actually highlighting a risk of personal referrals then, isn't it?
Yeah.
When it all goes to hell.
Yeah, you're all in it together. The only thing I would say then is a red flag in that scenario. If it feels like it's too good to be true, if it feels like someone has the secret sauce or the magic to give you some incredible outcome that's never really happened before, you should be suspicious.
It's probably
of that.
Too good to be true.
Mm.
Yes. I think you're right.
I am.
That's a pretty depressing note to end on.
Yeah, that's
really,
a terrible note to end on. Remind me again about how good your experience has been with the any other thoughts for people who are wrestling with this issue? Coming back to the podcast I did with Paul, he did a fabulous job of articulating how much of the financial planning work you can do yourself, how valuable and important it is to get on top of your own finances, how much information is available to you. If you just face into your own scenario, then you do the work to understand how much more you need and from whom.
I reckon, I haven't listened to that podcast, but I'm going to go and do that straight after this, because I think he's absolutely on the money there. I think we're so lucky to live in an era when information is freely available after a few clicks.
Mm.
And that must put us in a better position than ever to be ready to go into a meeting with a couple of financial planners, understand what they have to offer and how they can help us meet our particular goals. And that preparation work and asking lots of questions, I think, is the key to finding the right person. I often hear people say, oh, look, I know this is a dumb question. That's insane. Mm. I can't imagine that there's any such thing as a dumb question when it comes to looking after your financial future.
Meg, thanks so much for joining me. This is a really tricky topic, and I'm so grateful we've had this conversation. I'm sorry we can't give you a silver bullet when you're listening to go and find the perfect person for you. We can't give you a name and a website, but we hope that it has equipped you with a few more tools to go and find the right person for you. As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Your Wealth podcast. I hope very much it's been useful to you in helping you on your path to building and preserving your wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.